wasn't really bothered about the time. It just seemed like a habit. It was quite a common one, actually, the way people check smartphones today. He stared at me. He picked up a letter from his desk. It was the one I had written. He read excerpts back to me. "Dear Dr. Hutchinson," his voice was rich and dry, like port, "I am a great admirer of your work, and happened upon an article you had written on the subject of the new disease you discovered, whereby the body ages before its time. I myself have a strange condition, one similar in nature, though, if anything, even more unfathomable. It appears to me that you are the only man in all of Christendom who might be able to give me an explanation, and thereby put a lifetime's mystery to rest." He carefully folded the letter and put it aside on his desk. Then he studied me carefully. "Your skin is illuminated with health. It is the skin of a healthy man." "I am healthy. In body, healthier than most people." "Where is your problem?" "Before I speak, I must have assurance that I can remain unidentified. That if you were to publish any findings that arise due to what you discover, my name will not be found in any journals. This is of the utmost importance. Do I have that assurance?"
"Of course."
"Now you have aroused my curiosity. Tell me, what is your problem?" And so I told him.
"I am old," I said simply.
I'm older than is meant to be."
It took a second, but then he seemed to absorb it. His voice changed after that, became a little less sure of itself.
The question demanded to be asked, even though I could see he was scared to ask it.
"How old?"
"Older than is possible," I said. "Possibility is everything that has ever happened. The purpose of science is to find out where the limits of possibility end. When we have achieved that, and we shall, there will be no more magic, no more superstition. There will just be what is. Once it was impossible that this globe we are on wasn't flat. It is not for science, and certainly not for medicine, to flatter our expectations of nature, quite the opposite."
He looked at me for a long time. Then he leaned forward and whispered something.
"Rotten fish."
"I'm not sure I understand."
He sat back, pursed his lips. There was a mournful look to him. "No one sees the connection between rotten fish and leprosy. But it is there. If you eat too much rotten fish, you will develop leprosy."
"Oh," I said. "I didn't know that."
"Of course, now, from the 21st century, I can positively say that if you eat rotten fish, you won't get leprosy. Though I have lived long enough to know that in another 200 years, it may be proven that eating rotten fish actually does cause leprosy, and that Dr. Hutchinson was actually right about this. If you live long enough, you realize that every proven fact is later disproved and then proven again. When I was little, the average person outside the scientific community still believed the Earth was flat, because they walked around, and that is what they saw. Then people began to finally get to grips with the idea that the Earth was spherical. But then the other day I was skimming through a copy of New Scientist magazine in W.H. Smith's, and it was all about something called the holographic principle. It's to do with string theory and quantum mechanics, and how gravity acts like a hologram. So anyway, the mind-boggling bit is that the theory hints that the entire universe is just two-dimensional information on a cosmological horizon, and that everything we think we see in three dimensions is really as much an illusion as a 3D movie, and it could all be a simulation. So really, the world and everything might be flat after all. And then again, it might not be. "So, tell me," he said, reminding me of the question that was still in the air. A question that I knew had to be answered. "How old are you?" So I told him. "I was born on the 3rd of March, in the year 1581. I am 271 years old." I expected him to laugh, but he didn't. He stared at me for a long, long time, as snow flurries danced busily outside the window, as if to mirror my swirling mind. His eyes widened,
and he pinched his lower lip between his fingers. And then he said, "Well, there. That settles the matter quite conclusively. Now I can set about and give you a diagnosis." I smiled. This was good. A diagnosis was precisely what I was after. "But for proper help, you will need to go to Bethlehem." I remembered passing the place, hearing the dull screams from inside. Bethlehem Hospital, as in Bedlam? The very same. But that's a place for lunatics. It is an asylum, yes. It will give you the help you need. Now, please, I have more appointments today. He nodded to the door. "But, please, I recommend that you visit Bethlehem. It will help with your delusions." The most fashionable philosopher at this time was the German Arthur Schopenhauer, who was still just alive. I had been reading a lot of him, which was probably inadvisable. Reading Schopenhauer when you felt melancholy was like taking off your clothes when you felt cold. But a line of his came back to me. "Every man takes the limits of his own field of vision for the limits of the world." I had thought, in coming to Dr. Hutchinson, I was coming to the man with the broadest field of scientific vision, the one most likely to understand my condition, and having this belief slip away felt like a kind of grief, the death of hope itself. I was beyond every field of vision. I was a kind of invisible man. As a result, I became quite animated. I pulled a coin from my pocket. "Look at this! Look at this penny! It is Elizabethan! Look! Look! My daughter gave it me when I had to go away." "That is an antique coin. I have a friend who has a silver coin from the reign of Henry VIII, a half-groat, I think it is called, and I assure you my friend was not born in the age of the Tudors, and that a half-groat is rarer than a penny. I am not deluded. I promise you. I have been alive for a long time. I was there when the British found Tahiti. I knew Captain Cook. I worked for the Lord Chamberlain's men. Please, sir, you must tell me. Has someone else been to see you? A girl, a woman, talking of the same condition. Her name was Marion, but she could have called herself something else. She might have been masquerading under another identity. In order to survive, we often need to..." Dr. Hutchinson looked worried now. "Please, go. I see you are getting agitated." "Of course I'm agitated. You are the only man who can help me. I need to understand myself. I need to understand why I am like this." I grabbed his wrist. His hand shrank away as though my madness could be contagious. "We are a stone's throw from the police station. If you don't see yourself out, I will call for help and the police will come and take you away." There were tears in my eyes. Dr. Hutchinson clouded into a ghost of himself. I knew I had to leave. I knew I had to give up hope, for a little while at least. So I stood up and nodded and left without a single word more, and kept myself and my history a secret for another 31 years. London and St. Albans, 1860 to 1891. After that first meeting with Dr. Hutchinson, I slipped into a state beyond my usual grief and restlessness and anxiety and despair, one of not feeling anything at all. And when I felt nothing, I almost became nostalgic for the grief. At least when you felt pain, you knew you were still alive. I had tried to fight this, forcing myself into life and noise. I had gone on my own to a few of the new music halls, always sitting near the front, right in the heart of the noise and laughter, and I laughed or sang along, trying to feel some of the joy that filled the room. But I was immune. So, one baking hot August day in 1880, I walked from Whitechapel to St. Albans. London was too much for me. Too many memories. Too many ghosts. It was time to be someone else again. I suppose the way I understand my life is as a kind of Russian doll, with different versions inside other versions, each one enclosing the other, whereby the life before isn't seen from the outside, but is still there. For years I thought the key was to keep building new shells on top of the old ones, to keep moving, to keep changing, to keep transforming into something else in the eyes of society. St. Albans wasn't far from London, but it was far enough. It was as new a place to me as any place in England could be, and I found work as a farrier. People now think of the early 1880s being an industrial time of smoke and factories, but as with every age, it was a carousel of many periods at once. The past stays and echoes, even as modernity roars ahead. It was still the age of the horse and cart, and blacksmiths were thriving as much as they had ever been. But in St. Albans, things became worse. I would sometimes lose myself completely, and just stare into the orange heat of the forge, hardly aware of myself or anything at all. On occasion, my manager, Jeremiah Cartwright, would elbow me or slap me on my back and tell me to climb down from the clouds. Once, when I was on my own, I took a desperate action in the pursuit of feeling. I pulled up my sleeve, took a searing piece of iron curved into a horseshoe from the flames, and pushed it against the top of my left forearm. I held it there as my skin hissed and cooked beneath it, and I clenched my jaw and eyes tight and contained the scream. I still have that scar, like a half-smile, and I get a strange comfort when I look at it. Though it is another thing I have to be careful about, another thing I have to conceal, a distinguishing mark interfering with my anonymity. It worked, I suppose. I felt the pain. It had come in and screamed through me with mind-pulsing intensity. I had to exist, I realized, because for pain to be felt, there must be a living presence, a me, to feel it. And there was a reassurance in that knowledge, that proof of my own reality. But I still sought proof that I wasn't mad. Then one day, a thought occurred to me. The thought was this. Maybe I did have the proof. I, myself, was the evidence, and time was the proof. And so it was that I decided to take that evidence one final time to Dr. Hutchinson. London, 1891. Dr. Hutchinson didn't know it was me. I mean, he wouldn't have recognized the name from the list of appointments, because the last time he had seen me, I was Edward Cribbs, and now I was back, for the first time since my youth, with my true name again. Well, true first name. I was Tom. Not the Huguenot Hazard, or the dull Smith, but the rather more symbolic Winters. It was a warm day, the 4th of June, and I had ridden into town on a horse-dragged cart that belonged, both the cart and the horse, to my sullen boss, Jeremiah. The London Cutaneous Institution for Treatment and Cure of Non-Infectious Diseases of the Skin was now called the London Skin Clinic, but otherwise everything was still much as I remembered it. The fine furnishings, the three flights of stairs, even Dr. Hutchinson's office was much as before, though somewhat more cluttered. His desk now overflowed with papers and open books, and his leather chair had a rip in it. It was still essentially the same place, but it looked like it had been hit by a whirlwind. Dr. Hutchinson, like most humans, had aged far ahead of his environment. His once distinguished beard was now wispy and grey and sparse. The whites of his eyes were yellowing, and his hands were twisted with arthritis and spotted from time. And that rich, plum voice now came with raspy intakes of breath. He was, in short, an ordinary human, and time was doing its work. "So, Mr. Winters, now, I don't seem to have any notes for you." He hadn't looked up since I had entered the room. He just stared down at the chaos of papers on his desk. "When I arranged the appointment, I didn't give any information." And it was then that he looked at me. At first he noticed my unclean clothes and blackened hands, and might have wondered what a rough-dressed man like myself was doing in his office. I settled the payment downstairs, I said, clearing my throat. I am now wondering if you recognize me. He looked up. His eyes met mine. The last time I came to see you, I did so under the name of Edward Cribbs. Do you remember that name? Do you remember? You advised me to go to the lunatic asylum. The rasping of his breath grew louder. He stood up out of his leather chair and came over to me. He stood 10 inches from my nose. He rubbed those aged eyes. A whisper. No. You remember, don't you? You do. I can see. 31 years ago. He was out of breath, as if the realization was a hill he had climbed. No. No. No, no, it can't be. It is an illusion. You might be masculine or cook. Masculine and cook were the illusionist double act of the day, who'd just been doing a host of London shows. I assure you it is I, sir. I must have taken leave of my senses. It was depressing that he found it so much easier to question his sanity than my reality. No, sir, I assure you that you haven't. The condition I told you about, my condition, the condition of holding back the tide of years, the condition that sounds like a blessing but which is also a curse, is real. I am real. My life is real. This is very real. You are not a ghost? No. You are not a spectre of my mind? No. His hand reached out to touch my face. What was the day of your birth? I was born on the 3rd of March in the year 1581. 1581? He repeated it not as a question, but as something so incredible it needed saying before it could be absorbed. 1581. 1581. You were 85 years old when the Great Fire of London. I felt its heat. Its sparks singed my skin. He stared at me in a new way, as if he was a paleontologist and I was a fresh dinosaur egg ready to hatch. Well, 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 this changes everything. Everything. Tell me, are you the only one? Have you ever known anyone else like you with this condition? Yes, I said. There was a man I met once, during Captain Cook's second voyage, a man from the Pacific Islands. His name was Omai. He became the rarest of things, a friend to me. And also, my daughter, Marion. I've not seen her since she was a girl. Her mother told me that she had inherited my condition, that she stopped aging normally around 11 years of age. Dr. Hutchinson smiled. This is a gigantic thing to comprehend. And I smiled too, and felt the soul-anchoring joy of being understood. And this joy stayed inside me right up until Dr. Hutchinson's body was found floating in the Thames 13 days later. London, now. I still have a headache. Sometimes it is almost not there, while at other times that is all there is, and the pain always coincides with memories. It is less a headache and more a memory ache, a life ache. No matter what I do, it never goes completely. I have tried everything. I've taken ibuprofen, drunk liters of water, had lavender-scented baths, lain in the dark, rubbed my temples in slow circles, slow-breathed. Listened to lute music and the sound of waves on a beach, meditated, did a stress relief yoga video course where I repeated the mantra, I am safe, it's okay to let go, about 100 times until I felt terrified of my own voice, watched brain-dead TV, stopped drinking caffeine, turned the brightness down on my laptop. But still, the headache stays, as stubborn as a shadow. The one thing I haven't properly tried is sleep. I have a trouble with sleep that has been growing over the decades. Last night I couldn't sleep, so I watched a documentary about turtles. They aren't the longest living species, but they are one of them, and some turtles live to over 180. I put that in inverted commas because mayfly estimates such as these always turn out to be underestimates. Just look at how wrong they were about sharks, or, well, humans. My bet is that there is at least one turtle out there approaching her 500th birthday. Anyway, the thing that was depressing me was that humans weren't turtles. Turtles have been around for 220 million years, since the Triassic period. And they haven't really changed that much. Humans, in contrast, have been around only a short while. And you don't have to be a genius to switch on the news and conclude, we probably don't have long. The other human subspecies, such as the Neanderthals, the Denisovans in Asia, the casually named Hobbits of Indonesia, have proven crap at the long game, and so, most likely, would we. It is all right for the mayflies. It is all right if you know you only have another 30 or 40 years. You can afford to think small. You can find it easy to imagine that you are a fixed thing inside a fixed nation with a fixed flag and a fixed outlook. You can imagine that these things mean something. The longer you live, the more you realize that nothing is fixed. Everyone will become a refugee if they live long enough. Everyone would realize their nationality means little in the long run. Everyone would see their worldviews challenged and disproved. Everyone would realize that the thing that defines a human being is being a human. Turtles don't have nations, or flags, or strategic nuclear weapons. They don't have terrorism or referendums or trade wars with China. They don't have Spotify playlists for their workouts. They don't have books on the decline and fall of turtle empires. They don't have internet shopping or self-service checkouts. Other animals don't have progress, they say. But the human mind itself doesn't progress. We stay the same glorified chimpanzees, just with ever bigger weapons. We have the knowledge to realize we are just a mass of quanta and particles, like everything else's. And yet, we keep trying to separate ourselves from the universe we live in, to give ourselves a meaning above that of a tree or a rock or a cat or a turtle. So here I am, with my head full of human fears and pains, my chest tight with anxiety, thinking about how much future I have in front of me. I'm lucky these days if I manage 3 hours of sleep. In the old days I used to take quieting syrup, a kind of cough mixture recommended by Henry. But quieting syrup contained morphine, and so they stopped making it when they prohibited opiates 100 years ago. So now I have to make do with Beecham's night nurse, which never really hits the spot. I should have gone to the doctor, of course, but I didn't. It was a rule of the Albatross Society. No doctors. Not for anything. And it was easy, after my guilt over Dr. Hutchinson, to follow this through. I have wondered if it was a tumour, though I've never heard of an alba having a tumour. And obviously, if I have one, it would be very slow-growing. One that would give me at least an average human lifespan ahead of me. But no, the symptoms aren't even close. Anyway, the headache is there with only one day to go before the new job. I drink some water and eat some cereal, and then I take Abraham for a walk. He had spent the night eating the arm of the sofa, but I don't want to judge him. He has enough issues already. I suppose I needed a dog with problems in order to think less about my own. Akitas were made for the Japanese mountains, so I knew that he was a comrade of sorts, someone made for more noble surroundings, reduced to the grime and pollution and concrete streets of East London. No wonder he pissed on the carpet and ate the sofa. This wasn't the life he'd asked for. So we walk along, myself and Abraham, with all the exhaust fumes in our faces. There used to be a well here, I tell him, as we pass a betting shop. And here, right here, that's where all the men used to play skittles after church on a Sunday. A teenage boy passes us, in turned-up trousers and an oversized The Hundreds t-shirt. looking like an oblivious, distant echo of a 17th-century London boy of his age in Rhinegrave breeches and overskirt. The boy looks up from his phone and glances at me with quizzical and disapproving eyes. To him, I am just another loose-screwed London loner talking to myself. Maybe he is going to be one of the pupils I will be teaching on Monday. We cross over the road. We pass a lamppost with an advert tied to it. The Candlelight Club. Relive the roaring 20s at London's top speakeasy-themed cocktail bar. My headache intensifies, and I close my eyes, and a memory rises like a cough. Playing Sweet Georgia Brown at Ciro's piano bar in Paris, with a stranger's hand resting softly on my shoulder. I'm in the park now. I hadn't played the piano for years, I realize. I am fine with that, most of the time. I have long convinced myself that the piano is like a drug, seductive and strong, and it can mess you up. It can awaken dead emotions. It can drown you in your lost selves. It is a nervous breakdown waiting to happen. I wonder if I will ever play again. I unclip the lead from Abraham's collar, and he stays by my side and looks up at me, confused, as if perplexed by the concept of freedom. I relate. As I stare around the park, I see a man with a Bichon Frise discreetly scoop up shit with a plastic bag. A squirrel darts in jerky zigzags up the trunk of a beech tree. The sun climbs out from behind a cloud. Abraham trots away. It is then that I notice her. A woman sitting on a bench, reading, a short distance away. I recognize her, which itself is rare. I hardly pay much attention to what people look like anymore. Faces blur into other faces. But I know instantly. This is the woman I saw out of the window of Daphne's office, the French teacher. As then, she seems wholly herself. It takes a lot to be unique in a species of so many. She has style. I don't mean in what she's wearing, corduroy blazer, jeans, glasses, though that is perfectly fine. I mean in the easeful way in which she places the book down beside her on the bench and stares around at the park. In the way she puffs out her cheeks a little, and blows, and closes her eyes, and tilts her head up to invite the sun. I look away. I am a man in a park, looking at a woman. I could be anyone. It isn't 1832 anymore. But then, as I look away from her, she calls over. "Your dog is lovely." She has a French accent. The new French. "Yes." It is definitely the same woman I had seen. She holds out the back of her hand for Abraham to smell. Abraham licks his gratitude and even wags his tail. "You're honored." And then she looks up at me in a rather unsettling way. A little too long. I am not arrogant enough to believe I'm so attractive it is difficult for her to turn away. In reality, I haven't had those sort of looks from anyone for at least 100 years. In the 1700s, when I looked in my 20s and wore my grief like a scar, I was often the subject of long, lingering gazes, but not these days. No, she is looking at me for another reason, and that troubles me. Maybe she had seen me, too, at the school. Yeah, that was probably it. "Abraham! Abraham! Here, boy! Here!" The dog pants his way to me, and I clip on his lead and I walk away. Even as I feel her eyes on the back of my neck. At home, I start looking at lesson plans for the year sevens, and the first topic to appear on the dim-lit screen is witch trials in Tudor England, which I already know is integral to the syllabus. I realize there is a reason I'm doing this, why I want to become a history teacher. I need to tame the past. That is what history is. The teaching and telling of it is a way to control it and order it, to turn it into a pet. But history you have lived is different to history you read in a book or on a screen, and some things in the past can't be tamed. My brain suddenly hurts. I rise and walk kitchenward and find myself making a Bloody Mary. Basic, No stick of celery. I play some music, simply because music sometimes helps. I resist Tchaikovsky's Sixth, and Billie Holiday, and my sea shanty Spotify playlist, and go for The Boys of Summer by Don Henley, which was written yesterday. Actually, 1984. I have liked this song ever since I first heard it, in Germany in the 80s. I don't know why. It always makes me think of my childhood, even though it was made centuries after it. It reminds me of the poignant French chanson Maman used to sing, the one she chose after we had moved to England, the sad, nostalgic ones. And I think, as the headache continues, how the pain in John Gifford's head all that time ago must have been a whole infinity worse. And I close my eyes and feel those early memories come rolling back with the power to thin the air. Suffolk, England, 1599. This is what I remember. My mother sat beside my bed, singing in French and playing her cherrywood lute, her fingers running fast across the strings as if escaping something. Normally, music was her escape. I never saw my mother more calm than when she was gently singing an air de cour. But this evening, something was troubling her. She was a beautiful singer, and always closed her eyes when she sang, as if songs were dreams or memories. But today her eyes were open. She was staring at me with that vertical crease in her forehead. It was the crease that always appeared whenever she thought about father or the trouble in France. She stopped playing. She set down the lute. A gift from the Duke of Rochefort, when I was still a baby.
You do not change. Maman, please, not again. There is not a hair on your face. You are 18 now, but you still look much as you did 5 years ago. Maman, I cannot help the way I look. It is as though time has stopped for you, Etienne.
She still called me Etienne at home, even if I was always Thomas in public. I tried to hide my own worry and reassure her.
Time hasn't stopped. The sun still sets and rises. Summer still follows spring. I have been working as hard as anyone my age.
Mother stroked my hair. She could see only the child I still seemed to be.
I don't want more bad things to happen.
One of my earliest memories came to me, of her howling with grief and burying her face in a tapestry hanging in the hall of our vast home in France on the day we found out my father had been killed by cannon fire on a battlefield near Reims.
I will be fine. Yes, I know the money from touching is good, but maybe you should stop working for Mr. Carter. Everyone can see you up on the Giffords' roof, thatching, and they talk. Everyone is talking now. It's a village.
The irony was that during my first 13 years of life, I aged quickly. Not unnaturally quickly, but certainly quicker than average. This was why Mr. Carter had recruited me. I had been young, so he could pay me cheap, but I had been tall and broad and strong-armed for a 13-year-old. The trouble was that after such fast development, to suddenly slow to what seemed like no change at all, must have made it more noticeable.
We should have gone to Canterbury, I said, or London. You know what I am like in towns?
She paused, reconsidered, smoothed her petticoat. I looked at her. It seemed wrong that my mother, who had lived most of her life in one of the finest houses in France, was reduced to living in a two-room cottage in a village full of suspicious minds in this faraway corner of England.
Maybe you are right. Maybe we should.
There was a sound outside. A terrible wailing. I quickly put on my trousers and shoes and went to the door.
No, son, stay inside.
Someone is hurt, I told her.
I'd better see.
I ran out, and the day was at that last point before night, after sunset, where the sky is a fragile finch-egg blue. There was enough light to see people doing what I was doing, rushing out of their cottages further along the lane, all trying to see what the commotion was. I kept running,
And I saw it. Him. John Gifford. He was a long way off, but he was easy to recognize. He was as large as a haystack. He was walking along with his arms hanging by his sides in a strange fashion, as if they were dead things attached to him. He vomited, twice, violently, leaving rancid puddles on the lane, and then staggered forward. His wife Alice and the three children followed like panicking cygnets, letting out wails of their own. By the time he had made it to the green, the whole of Edwardston seemed to be there. We could see the blood now. It was pouring out of his ears, and after a cough, it streamed out of his mouth and his nose, too, flowing into his beard. He fell to the ground. His wife was there next to him, placing a hand over his mouth and another over his ear, desperately trying to plug the flow of the blood.
"Oh, John! Oh, Lord, save you, John! Oh, Lord! John!"
Some of the crowd were praying. Others were shielding their children from the sight, pressing their faces into their clothes. Most, though, were staring in grim fascination.
"Lucifer's work," said wide-eyed Walter Earnshaw, the knife grinder.
He was standing next to me, stinking of hops and what we would now call halitosis. John Gifford was still now, lying face up, except for a shaking in his arms, which became less and less. And then he died, right there on the green, on the black, blood-sodden grass. While Alice collapsed on top of him, the sudden grief convulsing out of her, the villagers just stood there, by and large, in a numb kind of silence. It felt wrong, being witness to such private pain, so I turned away. But as I walked past the familiar faces, I saw the baker's wife, Bess Small, staring right at me with accusing eyes.
"Yes, Thomas Hazard, mind you stay away now."
At the time, the words confused me. But not long after, I would remember them as a warning. I turned, once, and saw John Gifford, still as a mound, his large, dead hands shining. Then I kept walking, watched by the moon, which stared from the sky like another horrified face. London. Now. "Witches," I say, in the voice of a teacher. That is, a voice that isn't really heard. So, this is the life I have chosen above all others. The life of a man standing in a room of 12-year-olds ignoring him. Why do you think people 400 years ago wanted to believe in witches? I survey the room. The faces are smirking or embarrassed or checking their phones or all three. It is 9:35 a.m. We are only 5 minutes into the lesson. It is going badly. The lesson, the day, the job, it is all going badly. Maybe being a teacher wasn't a new beginning for me. Maybe it was just the newest in a line of disappointment. I had, right up until Sri Lanka, spent 8 years in the north of Iceland, 10 miles north of the fishing village of Kópasker. I had wanted Iceland, because before that I had spent a few years in Toronto. Toronto is the greatest and happiest city on earth, but despite that, maybe because of that, it made me unhappy, as I just lived in an apartment there, never seeing anyone. Once I went to watch the Blue Jays play baseball, but being surrounded by so many people who I knew I could never connect with was the thing that had made me want to go to Iceland. And all that living alone in Iceland had done was make me want an ordinary life. But an ordinary life is not a guarantee of happiness. And of course this, being a teacher, was just a pretense. Maybe everyone was pretending something. Maybe every teacher and pupil at the school was pretending something. Maybe Shakespeare was right. Maybe all the world was a stage. Maybe without the act, everything would fall apart. The key to happiness wasn't being yourself, because what did that even mean? Everyone had many selves. No, the key to happiness
is finding the lie that suits you best. And right then, staring at those smirking 12-year-olds, I think, this is the wrong lie. Why did people believe in witches? I repeat. Daphne walks along the corridor outside. She gives me a smile and two thumbs up as she passes by at a busy pace. I smile back, acting as if this is great fun and I am doing it well, like a natural, like someone who had done this before many times, and not like the oldest of dogs learning a new trick. I repeat my question. What made people want to believe in witchcraft? At first, it looks like a girl on the front row is putting up her hand to answer, but it is just a yawn. So I answer my own question. I try my best not to remember what this topic makes me remember. I try to cement over the cracks in my voice. People believed in witches because it made things easier. People don't just need an enemy, they need an explanation. And it's often useful, in unsettled times where ignorance is everywhere, for people to believe in witches. Who do you think believed in witches? Stupid people, someone says. It is a mumble, hard to locate. I smile. There are 55 minutes left of the lesson. You'd think so, but no, it was all kinds of people. Queen Elizabeth I passed a law against them. Then the one after her, King James, he considered himself an intellectual, and he even wrote a book about them. The first technology to lead to fake news wasn't the internet, it was the printing press. Books solidified the superstition. Almost everybody believed in witches, and there were witch finders who travelled around the country finding... There was a sudden sharp pain, an intensifying of the headache, radiating from my inner brain, causing me to hesitate, dangerously, mid-sentence. The yawning girl on the front row now looks concerned.
Are you all right, sir?
Yes, I've just got a bit of a headache. I'll be fine. Then, someone else. Another girl, near the back.
So, how did they find out if someone was a witch or not? What did they do?
And the question flaps around my head like a crow in a dark room.
What did they do? What did they do? What did they do?
Suffolk, England, 1599. My mother was, in the tradition of parents, quite a complicated and contradictory human being. Moralistic, but a devout lover of pleasure, food, music, the aesthetics of nature. Deeply religious, but seemingly as comforted by singing a secular chanson as by prayer. A lover of the natural world, who was visibly anxious every time she left the castle. Fragile, but also tough and stubborn. I never knew how many of her oddities had sprung from grief, and how many from her own inherent nature.
There is not one blade of grass. There is no colour in this world that is not intended to make us rejoice,
my mother told me once, shortly after arriving in England.
That is what Monsieur Calvin says.
I didn't like Monsieur Calvin, or Calvin, I should say, because he seemed to be the source of all our problems. Well, he had been, but I had taken the baton, and our problems were getting worse now, quite quickly, and I knew, when they came and knocked on the door, that there was nowhere for us, nowhere in the world where we could be safe. The witch finder, the pricker, as his job was known, was called William Manning. He was a tall, solid, square-faced man from London, thinning hair but broad-shouldered and strong, with thick butcher's hands. He was half blind, or appeared to be, on account of the cataract over his left eye. We never saw him arrive in the village, though I do remember waking to hear two galloping horses heading east past our house. The rider of the other horse was the Justice of the Peace. I never knew him as anything other than Mr. Noah. He was dressed in fine clothes and fancied himself a gentleman. He was also tall, but grey-skinned, death-like, cadaverous, a word I wasn't to pick up for another 200 years or so. We were county-level news now, though we had no accurate idea of our importance until the hard, quick knock on the door. William Manning grabbed my wrist. He had a tough grip. He pointed with his free hand to a small pink blotch on my skin, but was careful not to touch it.
"The devil's spot," Manning said with grim triumph. "Mark there, Mr. Noah."
Mr. Noah looked. "Oh, I see it. Most sinister." I laughed. I was scared.
"No," I told them. "It's a flea bite."
I still looked 13. They expected the obedience of a boy, not the insolence of a young man. Manning glowered at me. There was no other verb then or now. But then his attention turned to my mother.
"Undress yourself," he said,
his voice quiet and stern. I hated him. Right then, I had never really known hate before. Only in the abstract, for the men who killed my father. But I had never known what they looked like. Hate needs a face.
"No,"
I said. My mother was confused. Then, when she understood, she said no and insulted them in French. Manning was an ignorant man, masquerading as a man of learning, and had no idea of the language she was speaking.
"Mark her. She speaks like a devil. She is invoking foul spirits."
It was at this point that he asked for the door to be closed as an assortment of villagers, including Bess Small herself, her face full of gleeful disapproval, standing next to poor Alice Gifford, were now there on our doorstep, excited by the unfolding drama. Mr. Noah closed the door. I stood between Manning and my mother. Manning pulled out a dagger and held it at my throat. Mother undressed. She cried. I felt my eyes warm up, too. Fear and guilt. This was all my fault. The fault of my physical strangeness, of my body's inability to age.
"If you say another word, your witch mother will be killed right where she is, before you or Marbas can see it different."
Marbas, the infernal spirit who could cure all diseases. I was going to hear the name a lot over the coming hours, as that nightmare day unraveled itself. My mother was naked, there by the table and the tin pottage bowls. And I saw Manning's eyes feast on her, hating her for his own temptation. He stuck the tip of his dagger against her skin and pricked her, first on her shoulder, then her forearm, then near her navel. Little bulbs of blood.
"Look at the darkness of the blood, Mr. Noah."
Mr. Noah looked. The blood was blood colour, because it was ordinary human blood. But Mr. Noah saw something else in it, or imagined he did, as he was impressed by Manning's air of authority.
"Yes, it is most dark."
People only see what they have decided to see. I've learned this lesson 100 times over, but it was still new to me then. My mother winced every time that dagger touched her. But to Manning, she was faking it.
"See her cunning? Mark the counterfeit of pain on her face. She has made some kind of trade, it would appear. The most unusual death of John Gifford appears to be the price of her son's eternal youth. Quite a malevolent trade."
"We have nothing to do with John Gifford's death. I helped thatch his roof, that is all. My mother never even knew him. She stays in the cottage most of the time. Please stop doing that."
I couldn't watch any more. I grabbed Manning's arm. He hit the dagger handle against my head, then his other hand grabbed my throat, and he repeatedly struck the handle in the same spot as my mother wailed, and I thought my skull might smash open. I was on the floor, dazed and silent, and wishing my body was as strong as an 18-year-old's body should have been. And then he, Manning, spotted another flea bite, this time on my mother, near her belly button, like a little red moon above a planet.
"The same mark as on the boy."
My mother trembled. Robbed of her clothes, she could no longer speak.
"It's a flea,"
I said, my voice pained and desperate and cracked.
An ordinary flea bite!
And I pressed my hands into the stone of the floor to stand back up. But there came another stamp against the back of my skull. And after that, everything went dark. I sometimes repeat this in a dream. If I fall asleep on the sofa, I remember that day. I remember the bulbs of blood on my mother's skin. I remember the people at the doorway. And I remember Manning and his foot stamping down, jolting me awake through the distance of centuries. You see, everything changed after that. I'm not saying my childhood had been perfect before this point, but now I often want to climb back into that time before. Before I knew Rose, before I knew what would happen to my mother, before. To cling to who I was right at the beginning when I was just a small boy with a long name who responded to time and grew older like everybody else. But there is never a way into the before. All you can do with the past is carry it around, feeling its weight slowly increase, praying it never crushes you completely. London, now. At lunch break, I nip to the supermarket down the street and buy myself a pastrami sandwich, some salt and vinegar crisps, and a small bottle of cherry juice. There is a queue for the checkout assistant, so I do what I normally resist and use the self-service checkout. Like the rest of the day so far, it does not go well. The disembodied female voice keeps telling me of an unidentified item in bagging area, even though the only items in the bagging area are the items I had just scanned. Please ask a member of staff to assist you, she, the robot future of civilization, adds. Unidentified item in bagging area. Please ask a member of staff to assist you. Unidentified item in bagging... I look around. Hello? Excuse me? There are no members of staff. Of course there aren't. There is, however, a group of teenage boys all wearing variations of the Oakfield uniform, white shirts and a few green and yellow ties, all in the queue, holding drink cans and packets of food and looking in my direction. They say something, identifying me as a new teacher. And then there is some laughter. I feel the most familiar feeling of all, that I am living in the wrong time. And I stand there, just staring at the screen and listening to the voice, my head aching and my soul slowly wondering if Hendrich was right. Maybe I shouldn't have come back to London. As I walk along the corridor to the staff room, I pass the woman with glasses, the one who I had seen in the park reading, the French teacher Daphne had told me about. The one who had stared at me in that disconcerting way. She is wearing red cotton trousers and a black polo neck and shiny patent flat shoes. Her hair is pulled back. A confident, civilized look. She smiles. It's you, from the park. Oh, yes, I say, as if I was only just remembering at that moment. That was you. I'm the new history teacher.
How funny.
Yes. Her smile is also a frown, as though I confuse her. I have lived long enough to know this look, and fear it. Hello, I say.
Hello there,
she says, with a slight French accent. I think of the forest, my mother singing. I close my eyes and see a sycamore seed spiraling beneath a hard blue sky. I feel a familiar sense of claustrophobia. Confinement, as if this world is never big enough to hide in. And that is it. I have to keep walking, as if I can also walk away from what she might be thinking. After my first day teaching, I sit at home next to Abraham with his head on my lap. He is asleep, lost in dog dreams. He flinches and twitches, like a stuttering image stuck between two moments. He whimpers a little. I wonder what memories he is reliving. I put my hand on him, stroking to soothe him. Slowly, the movement stops. He makes no sound but that of his breath.
It's all right,
I whisper.
It's all right. It's all right. It's all right.
I close my eyes, and I see the towering form of William Manning, as clear as if he is in the room. Suffolk, England, 1599. William Manning stared at the darkening sky, his expression severe. There was something theatrical about him, as if this was just a show. This was very much the nature of the times, this era of Marlowe and Jonson and Shakespeare. Everything was theatre. Even justice. Even death. Especially that. We were nearly 10 miles from Edwardston, but the whole village was there. You might imagine that in the 16th century, witch trials were a regular occurrence. They were not. Not really. They were a rare entertainment, and people came from miles around to watch and jeer and feel safe in a world where evil could be explained and found and killed. Manning spoke to me, but also the crowd. He was an actor. He could have been one of the Lord Chamberlain's men.
Your fate will be decided by your mother. If she drowns, her innocence shall be shown, and you shall live. If she lives and survives the stool, then you, as the progeny of a witch, will be sent to the gallows alongside your mother and dealt with there. Do you understand?
I stood by my mother, on the grassy bank of the River Lark, with my legs and wrists in irons, just as hers were. She, dressed again, was shaking and shivering like a wet cat, despite the warm day. I wanted to talk to her, to comfort her, but knew any communication between us would be seen as a plot or a plan to conjure malevolent forces. Only when they pulled her closer to the riverbank, closer to the stool, did words burst out of my mouth.
I'm sorry, Mother. It's not your fault, Etienne. It's not your fault. I am sorry. It is mine. We should never have come here. We should never have come to this place. Mother, I love you. I love you too, Etienne,
she said, a sudden defiance bursting fast out of her, even as she cried.
I love you too. You must be strong. You are strong, as your father was. I want you to promise. You must stay alive. Whatever happens, you must stay alive. Do you understand me? You are special. God made you this way for a purpose. You must find your purpose. Do you promise to live?
I promise, Mother. I promise, I promise, I promise.
I watched as they fastened her into the wooden chair. She pressed her legs together, not wanting to part her knees, as a last futile defense. So two men took a leg each and pulled her into position, pressing her back against the seat. She wriggled and screamed as the metal strap was fixed across the seat. I didn't watch as they raised her in the air. But when she reached the highest point, Manning told the wild-haired man holding the rope to halt.
Wait! Wait there!
And it was then I looked and saw my mother against that hard blue sky. Her head dropped, and she looked down at me, and I can still see those terrified eyes all these centuries later.
"Start the ordeal," said Manning, who had walked to the edge of the riverbank.
"No!"
I closed my eyes and heard the noise of the chair touching the water, and then I reopened my eyes. I watched her disappear, become a blur of green and brown, and then nothing at all. A rush of air bubbles rose to the river's surface. William Manning held his hand up and open the whole time, telling the man who held that horribly slack rope to keep her under. I looked at that large, meaty red hand, a brute's hand, praying for the fingers to close. Of course, whatever happened, she would die. And yet still, even as my own life hung in the balance, I wanted her to emerge from the water alive. I wanted her to speak again. I couldn't imagine a world without her voice. when they hoisted the chair and her dripping dead body out of the water. There was an answer left as a secret in the river. Had she pushed the air out of her in panic or deliberately? Had she sacrificed her life for mine?